This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky, and I am a typical American. I studied French for a few years in high school, but apart from ordering food and reading some street signs, I remember almost nothing. When I travel overseas, I arm myself with a few key phrases, but I quickly abandon them as Greek and Portuguese, Spanish and French, Czech and Turkish native speakers easily converse with me in English, usually apologizing along the way for how bad their English is. Why is it that Americans like me take bilingualism so lightly, while the rest of the world understands the importance of multicultural communication? Look at Denmark, where children grow up speaking Danish as a first language at home, start English as early as the second grade in school. They tack on a third language, maybe French or German, a few years later. Kids can leave school with a working, functional knowledge of three or maybe four languages. Research in cognitive science demonstrates the positive benefits of bilingualism, including limiting the progression of age-related decline in cognitive control. It can help to stave off the onset of dementia and Alzheimer's. Why is it that in our school systems, language programs are often the first to get cut when the budget needs to be cut? This hour, we're going to be talking about language education. Is language education something we value and care about? If so, or if not, why is it? What can we be doing better? You can join us at 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'd like to hear about some of your experiences of learning language in school, maybe for you or your children, how that has changed over time. Later, we'll also tackle this question. Why is it that bilingualism is seen as a virtue when it's about a rich five-year-old learning Mandarin, but as a vice by many in our country when multilingual immigrant families hang on to their language traditions? I want to bring in two guests from the Yale University studios in New Haven today. Claire Bowern is Associate Professor of Linguistics at Yale University. And Claire, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Beth Lapman is President of the Connecticut Council of Language Teachers and Director of World Languages at Hamden Public Schools. Beth, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you. It's also a pleasure to be here today.
Beth, I'm wondering if you can first briefly outline the general state of language education in the U.S. Is it as bad as I'm maybe making it sound?
I think we would have to look overall and just really make or take the position that we definitely fall behind in terms of the study of world language compared to Europe. We definitely are lacking.
We're lacking, and do we have standards that at all hold up to what Europeans or other countries do? I mean, what are you expected to get in terms of foreign languages when you come out of high school?
Well, currently, it's a very exciting time. We are celebrating. Our legislators are going to bat to try to expand the high school reform and try to encourage more secondary commitment to world language. We do have world readiness standards, but again, due to the lack of funding, and I think it's a mindset here in the United States that moving forward is a slow process. We are, with our national organizations, we really are making great progress. One of the biggest challenges here that I'd like just to point out in the state of Connecticut is that we don't have a world language consultant. We are going to bat for a world language consultant so that we can have more of a presence on the national level. Again, our national and our state organizations, such as ACTFL, the American Council for the Teachers of Foreign Language, do plenty of professional development for teachers to reach out and to become more knowledgeable, to be able to administer and align curricula across the country to our world readiness standards. But it's a work in progress, definitely a work in progress.
What are the languages that we are teaching most frequently in high schools these days? I mean, I grew up in a world where you had three choices. It was French, Spanish, or German. And most people took Spanish, and fewer numbers took the other two languages. Now, there is a wider variety of offerings, and as we've been hearing for years, there may be a push to get more kids learning languages like Arabic or Mandarin. Are you actually seeing that show up, Beth?
Yes, we actually are. The biggest shift we actually here in the state of Connecticut had a study from 2012, and of the participating school districts in the state of Connecticut, we did see that there has been a decline in French. There's been a decline in Latin. Spanish maintains, for the most part, consistent, and there has been a rise in Chinese. Also,
go ahead.
Pockets are popping up of teaching Arabic. We also see, you know, our demand, and again, I think we'll talk about that later in terms of our EL students coming from, you know, some of the backgrounds where you've got you see Farsi, you see Urdu, but right now I would say that on the rise is the study of Chinese. We see a lot of an increase in Chinese offerings in our high school, and Spanish maintains at the forefront.
Well, I want to turn to Claire and sort of talk about the idea of learning language as a younger person. I think, Claire, by the time you get to middle age like me, you bemoan the fact that you didn't learn languages when you were younger, and you actually literally find it more difficult to put any foreign phrases in your head or sit down with a Rosetta Stone and try to muddle your way through learning a language in midlife. Is it really true that younger people, students as young as kindergarten students, are going to be able to learn languages that much more easily than the rest of us?
Yes, in general it is true, although it's perhaps not quite as true as people sometimes think. So this idea that younger kids are much better at learning languages comes from an idea from linguistics called the critical period hypothesis, which is the idea that children, when they're learning their first language, basically learn that language with a minimal degree of difficulty. But as they get older, their grammatical structures, they learn the grammatical rules, and that starts to fossilize. And then by the time they're 7, 8, or 9 or so, those structures are pretty much in place, and they tend to, at that point, to make assumptions about their language based on what they already know rather than learning new structures. So, for example, I'm from Australia originally. You can hear that by my accent. I moved to the US late enough in life that I haven't acquired an American accent, even though I've been here for 15 years or so. I would also say, though, that a lot of the reason that kids are really good at learning language is that that's basically all they do. So if you think of your typical one-year-old, they're crawling, they're eating, they're sleeping, and they're listening to other people talking. So they have a lot of time to process language and to learn about it. Likewise, kids who are in school are learning a lot of things about their world, but they don't have as many competing attentions, competing things that they have to pay attention to. They don't have to look after, or they tend not to have to look after other family members and so on. Whereas it's certainly true that that brain plasticity decreases later in life, but adults also just have a lot more stuff that they're trying to do to get through their day.
And, of course, one of the things that it seems obvious, and I want to ask you, Claire, about whether or not it's actually as true as it seems, that if you're going to learn, say, a Romance language, you are a native English speaker and you're going to learn, say, Spanish, you end up dealing with, of course, the same alphabet. Many of the words have roots that you easily understand. The structures of sentences might be slightly different, but in essence, you're learning the same sort of language that is structured in a slightly different way. Whereas if you're teaching a five-year-old Mandarin or the Russian alphabet or Arabic, they're having to deal with new symbols, a new way of structuring language altogether. It seems maybe obvious, maybe I'm wrong, that those sorts of languages might well be easily understood or learned by a younger person than someone who has well-worn neural pathways about how language is supposed to go.
So it's certainly true that in general, the closer two languages are to one another, the easier it is to learn the second language. But there are many ways that languages can be different from each other or similar to each other. So you mentioned Russian, for example. So Russian has a different alphabet, but it has the same basic word order that English does. So you put the subject first, then you put the verb, and then the object goes after the verb. A language, so that's shared with French and German and Spanish and many other languages as well. Language like Japanese has the verb at the end of the sentence. So you have the subject first, then the object, and then the verb. But those sort of, so that's one difference between Japanese and English, but there are other similarities between English and Japanese. So if we think about adjectives, for example, in French, the adjectives go after the noun, but in Japanese, the adjectives go before the noun. So in that case, Japanese is like English, and French is different from English. I think one of the main benefits of learning one of the main ways that it's easier to learn a language that's closer is that you have to spend less time learning vocabulary, or you get a bit of a boost from the similarities in the words. So you don't have to memorize quite as much as you would if it's a language that is totally different from your first language. I found this when I was working on Aboriginal languages of Australia. There are about 300 languages in that country, and learning languages where the words look nothing like the English words. There's just a huge rote memorization task. Quite apart from the grammatical differences, you know, I'm going to get the grammar wrong in Spanish or in Bharati. I'm going to get some things right, and I'm going to get some things wrong because you can get the macro things right, but then the smaller details of particular constructions with particular words are always going to trip up non-native language speakers.
Mm. We were talking about learning foreign languages for Americans, and later in the program also about English as a second language programs here in the United States for those who come to the country speaking other languages. And we want to hear from you at 860-275-7266. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. We'll be getting to some of your phone calls in just a moment. Beth, you lived in Spain. You married a Spanish man. You've raised your kids in Spain, so you have some firsthand knowledge of this. Talk a bit about how language is taught differently in the schools in, say, Spain or other European countries.
Yes. Well, there is a priority put on second language acquisition, as I said earlier. I think the statistics, and once again, this goes back a couple of years, but 18% of Americans report speaking a language other than English, and as Claire has spoken about early language acquisition, my experience in Spain, that most of the children, the majority of children, their parents are really dedicated to starting the study of their second language. I've been back here in the States now for about 13 years, but when I was living in Spain, there were English academies, academias de inglés, and they still were popping up all over, quite a booming business to supplement the curricula in the school system. So, you know, families, communities, educators are dedicated to the study of the second language. My own two children, having been brought up with a native speaking English, it was interesting because, research says that we really need to make sure that we continue with the literacy in the first language. And it definitely is true that all of us, even if we are bilingual, we have one language that we are definitely a tad, if I may, stronger in. So with my own two children, it was interesting how I observed that because I always spoke to them in English, I made the assumption that their productive skills, so their speaking and their writing, would just come along. And that truly is a fallacy. You really do need to develop that. And I learned when I moved to the States here, and my oldest daughter was actually pre-adolescent, and my son was right at those early ages where he had just started his literacy acquisition, reading in the target language. My youngest really struggled with the acquisition of academic language. So, going back to, yes, in Europe, there's a big emphasis. If we look at countries, like Finland and Switzerland, all of these countries, they start second language. They place a great emphasis. And again, going to the whole idea of the funding, they're funded and supported.
Well, and I think in part, and Claire, I'd like for you to chime in on this. I think they're funded and supported in part because those countries believe that learning English certainly helps students gain mastery of something that they probably need to know in this world. It is true that when you go almost anywhere in the world today, if you can speak English, you can probably get by, and you might even be able to go have a productive job. Some other languages, maybe not so much. Claire, do you think that that's what's driving it, essentially just an economic imperative for the rest of the world to speak one centralized language, and it just happens to right now be English?
I certainly think that that's part of it. Although we could also think of the other benefits of learning a second language or a third language. And if we perhaps weighted those more in America as people do elsewhere in the world, then that might also be something we should take into account. So we've talked about the benefits of being able to communicate across the world in English. And of course, English is a global language, but there are still large parts of the world where English is not a primary means of communication and not a primary language for people to work in with outsiders. There are also other benefits to speaking more than one language. There's the social benefits that we've talked about, but there are the cognitive benefits you mentioned, lower rates of dementia, Alzheimer's, and so on, ability to continue to be active later in life. And I'd also stress the anthropological benefits of speaking more than one language. And this is something I think that to generalize broadly in Europe is perhaps better understood, that learning another language and speaking another language gives you a different way of seeing the world, and it gives you a different understanding of ways of living and ways of communicating. And so that, I think, is really important for everyone, not just for people who are adding English as a second language.
You mean that you're able to get your nose out of the tour book and actually go find some things that only native speakers might find, or overhear an interesting conversation in a coffee shop?
Right, that sort of thing.
It's so interesting, because that's the sort of thing that does indeed make travel so fascinating, and something that a lot of Americans, including myself, often miss out on. I want to quickly get to a phone call from Keith, who's calling from Middletown. Hi there, Keith. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I have heard of some high schools, I think like my high school, but after I left, allowing computer programming languages to be substituted for the language requirements. And I'm in software, and I've also learned foreign languages, and I don't think that's a legitimate substitution. I was wondering what your expert thought about that.
You know, thank you very much for that, Keith. And I have heard that, Beth. Is that something you've encountered, that essentially software languages, computer languages being substituted for foreign languages in schools?
Yes. Once again, there are pockets of that popping up, especially where, the resources to find the certified teachers becomes an issue. We definitely have a shortage here in the state of Connecticut for certified teachers. So we do rely on some of the online, especially now there are so many programs and really effective programs out there that we can use to supplement. But to answer Keith, I believe is his name. I am also a big proponent and advocate that, there's nothing like getting a group of kids to interact with one another, with a teacher facilitating the instruction, and using some of these online resources that we have in this, to really promote the interconnectedness, the social as a supplement, as an enrichment. I think that very strongly no program can replace a teacher. That's for sure.
I want to go to Joanne in New Milford. Hi, Joanne. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I just wanted to add something. You had a discussion before about how much more easily children learn a foreign language than adults. And I've taught both children and adults. I'm a French teacher. And I found that adults are much more conscious of making mistakes as opposed to the children, and especially with the pronunciation. And I guess, adults seem to be more worried about appearing stupid or whatever when they speak, as opposed to the children who, if they make a mistake, they laugh and they try it again. They don't have the fear that the adults have.
That's such an interesting point, Joanne. Do you think, Claire, that there's something to that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think Joanne has a really good point there, that a large part of learning how to speak a foreign language, or learning how to do anything, is to practice it. And if you're too scared to make a mistake to practice it, to put a sentence together, then you're not going to make as much progress. So I think she's absolutely on the money for that.
We're talking to Claire Bowern, who's an associate professor of linguistics at Yale University, and Beth Lapman, who's president of the Connecticut Council of Language Teachers. And we're talking about foreign language skills. When we come back from a break, we'll be talking more about English as a second language. You can tweet us at Where We Live. We've got a tweet from Artichoke Blue, who says, I studied French and Spanish in high school, Mandarin and Italian in college. The French stuck, and it comes back every time I vacation in France. Linda tweeted us. She says she learned French with a Pimsleur system and even got a compliment in Paris on her accent. You can join us with a call at 860-275-7266 as we consider language here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about foreign language acquisition. Why does it seem that Americans just don't learn foreign languages the way the rest of the world does? We're also going to look at the other side of the foreign language equation. Students who enter the classroom speaking Spanish or French or Chinese, those kids get placed in ELL or English Language Learner programs to learn English. They're learning a second language, but sometimes what they're doing is being treated differently than the kids who are learning English at a very young, or excuse me, learning Spanish at a very young age here in America. We're talking with Claire Bowern, who's an associate professor of linguistics at Yale University, and Beth Lapman, who's a director of world languages at Hamden Public School. She's also president of the Connecticut Council of Language Teachers. We'll be getting to some more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. But Claire, I wanted to ask you about an op-ed that you wrote in the Washington Post about the differences in bilingualism when it's ESL or ELL versus an English speaker learning another language. This is something we've actually talked about on the program before when we've talked about bilingual education here. And there does seem to be a sense in America, or at least amongst many Americans, that it is a virtue indeed to have your kindergartner grow up learning Mandarin or learning French. But when someone comes from another country, we expect them very quickly to adopt our language and our traditions. And the idea that they're being taught their home language at home is something that's not necessarily seen as virtuous. And it's a complicated question, I think, but one that you raise quite well.
Oh, thank you. I think this comes back to the characterization, the way you put this actually in the intro to this program, that there's a widespread perception that to be American is to be monolingual. Of course, that's not true from the earliest stages of America as a country. And before that, America has never been a monolingual country. There are 300 or more Native American languages that have been spoken and continue to be spoken in the country. There were early immigrants from all over Europe to the U.S. African American slaves brought their own languages from Africa. All of this multilingualism still exists in the U.S. Today. There are, I think Beth mentioned, about 17% of Americans speak a second language fluently, or speak another language fluently. It's probably their first language. America has a huge array of linguistic richness. There are it's often said that there are more languages spoken in New York than there are spoken in New York City than are spoken in the whole of Europe. So I'd say it's really unfortunate that that there's this perception that that monolingualism is something to be glorified when in more than half the world's population speaks a second language, and this perception is making it into the school system and making it into how students are treated, particularly how students from other backgrounds, from non-English speaking backgrounds, are treated when they enter the school system, and this is doing real damage to their learning prospects.
And talk a bit more about that, and maybe Beth, you can weigh in and talk about how students who do come with a few English language skills to America, how they are treated in the classroom, and perhaps how it is different than how American kids are allowed to learn a language like Spanish at their leisure.
Maybe
sure.
If I start, or
go ahead.
So it's pretty clear that the evidence is pretty clear that bilingual education works better than English immersion instruction. There's evidence from all around the world, not only from the US, from Australia, from Argentina, from pretty much everywhere that's looked at this this topic, that children do better learning when they can when they're not trying to learn the language at the same time they're trying to learn the content. And if you think about how we educate, say, the children of armed forces personnel abroad, they have access to English medium education because it's recognized that it's really difficult to learn a foreign language at the same time as you're trying to keep up with the curriculum material. And so the same applies to students here in the U.S. as well. Even though the circumstances where they might be learning a second language is different, the same principles still apply.
Yes, clear. And just adding to that, I think when we look at the programs here in the United States and how we service our ELs, our English language learners. There are different models, and depending on our distinct populations and all of our different school districts, they can all be effective. There's a push-in model where the ESL tutor actually goes in and works with the literacy team, and now as we see, the different tiers as defined by SRBI, it's really beneficial that we can have an expert in the area of English language acquisition work directly with our students. There are also other models. Another model is a pullout model where, as Claire has spoken, we really work with some of the kids who may be on our benchmark assessment, our last links. They've scored on the higher end, the 4 or inclusively the 5, where they might be able to exit the program. In the pullout model, we are in some districts are fortunate enough to have an ESL specialist working with that academic content to really be able to help those students, especially when we look at lessening that achievement gap. And we've all, following the press and seeing that our Commissioner Wenzel is really going to bat on this to try to lessen that achievement gap. So it really is exciting to see some of the legislation that's coming through in the program, such as the new standards for our ESL. And I'd just like to briefly speak about that.
Yeah.
They're in draft form, and on September 2nd, hopefully they will be approved at the State Board of Ed. And these are just fantastic. It's a 283-page document. In that document is collected for each level of our students. So again, making reference to the assessment, the benchmark assessment we use here in Connecticut, the last links. This document supports general education and content-specific instructors, teachers, so that regardless of the grade level and regardless of where the student is on the last links, there are supports, linguist supports, practices, as we call them, so activities and strategies to really support these students. So it's an exciting time. It really is an exciting time where we see that we really are trying to become better leaders, administrators, to be able to service REL students.
We want to get to some phone calls. People have a wide range of questions about English as a second language and about learning foreign languages here in the United States. So let's go first to Chris. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I have some experience in this area. I was a teacher in a dual language immersion program in California when I first started my teaching career, and it was wonderful. But politics came into play. Politics dictated that there was a law that was passed called English for the Children that actually outlawed the use of any language other than English in classroom instruction. And that pretty much did away with the program that I was in. In Connecticut, I've been an ELL teacher, but now I'm a regular English language classroom. So, one of the other concerns I think with this, these programs are wonderful. I love having kids that are bilingual and multilingual, but there's no funding for it. And I think that we've seen some programs cut that are both ELL programs, but also the more, I guess, enrichment type of programs for native English speakers speaking French. And really, like anything else in education, I think funding is the primary impediment to really putting in effective programs in place.
Chris, thank you so much for raising that. I appreciate it. And I think that Beth has talked a little bit about some of those issues at the state level, and hopefully funding for individual school districts and at the state level comes through for more of this work. A lot of people have questions around some of the things that we've raised so far, including Sally in Brantford. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Well, I've also always had an interest in Russian culture and Russian history. I've had Russian blue cats since 1987, and of course, Facebook is so international in nature, and I have a lot of international friends, and I actually have a kitten from Russia, and I'm thinking about taking a class in Russian through adult ed, this fall, in October.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if my 65-year-old brain can handle it. It seems to be a very complicated language. Another, as an aside, though,
yeah,
I noticed a lot of my international Facebook friends do speak English very, very well.
Sure. Well, and that's part of what we've talked about. And Sally, I'm going to put your question actually to our guest Claire here, and is ask about whether or not acquiring a language like Russian in your 60s is something that is possible, is easy. It seems as though, Claire, it's something that's probably possible, but maybe a little bit more difficult than if she started at a younger age.
I'd say yes, definitely. It's certainly possible to study a second language late in life. My father, for example, recently retired, and the first thing he did was he enrolled in French classes at the local continuing education center, and he's been doing that for a couple of years now, and really enjoys it. He's not fluent, but he is able to. To put sentences together and to talk about a range of topics and so on and so forth. For Russian, I would say that it's important to keep in mind that the alphabet is just one aspect of the language. So if you're having difficulties with learning Cyrillic characters and learning how to write, that won't stop you from learning how to memorize vocabulary or how to listen to the sounds. And so it might be. It might be easier to spend some time thinking about the best way you learn, and whether whether one aspect of the language is holding you up from other aspects. And you know, there are textbooks that focus more on oral language acquisition versus written language acquisition, and so on too. But I'd say definitely go for it.
Yeah, Sally, best of luck to you. Maybe you can pick up a few key phrases from those Russian cats of yours. Let's go to Marissa in Manchester. Hello, Marissa.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to make a comment on how immigrant families come and they're learning English. We have ELs learning English, and then they either stop learning their language either or learn literacy in their language. And I can speak to that because I'm from Peru. My husband is American, and we have a bilingual household. And I wanted my children to learn to speak and read in Spanish. So I was at the elementary school in our town. I was able to find other parents like me who wanted their children to learn how to read and write in Spanish. And it's something that we can do as a community to help our children to be bilingual, to learn literacy, and continue to learn their culture and get together and do it in the school setting and an after-school program and unite forces. And I was able to do that through the PTA.
Do you speak Spanish to your children at home?
Yes, I spoke Spanish to my children from birth. They grew up listening in Spanish, and we actually had the privilege of going to Peru and lived there for 6 months. And my children were able to go to school there and they were able to do very well there.
Well, and I think, and Marissa, thank you so much for the phone call. I think something that we've often heard is that immersion in a language is one of the best ways to learn. And Claire, can you confirm that you know, a few months spent abroad in a language that you have some skills with might be the best way to come out a bit more fluent? It's going to help you more than classroom learning here in the States?
I'd say that both are important. To make the most of an immersion experience, it's very helpful to know something about the language beforehand, because that allows you to make the most of the new information that you're acquiring from the language. I'd say one of the main things is the amount of time that you spend learning the language. So if you're in a classroom where you have, I don't know, 25 minutes three times a week or even an hour a day, that's still a small percentage compared to living in a country, doing all your interactions in that country in that language where you have to, basically you have to use the language, and so you get a lot more practice with it. So yes, it's better to it's easier to attain full fluency in a language if you're in an immersion context, but that is only true if you already know something about the language. It is better to have that experience after you already know something about the language, and so you've already got something to build on.
I want to. Oh, go ahead, Beth, please.
I just wanted to piggyback on that. And one of the things earlier, one of the questions that you had posed was in terms of standards and looking at the standards here in the United States. You know, that we use as a guide for instruction in our classrooms, and I just want to emphasize that our national organization, again, the American Council of Teaching of Foreign Languages, has a position statement, and this is something that we all grapple with, you know, in making sure it's not a pure immersion, aligned to a pure immersion thought, but the position statement says that we should be 90% of our instruction as world language teachers in the target language, again, that's really important to really give our students those authentic real life experiences, and definitely staying in the target language. And our new world language readiness standards provide really focus on communication and the interpersonal skills, much more than if we even go back 10 or 15 years ago, where there was more of a focus on grammar and methodologies. You know, Stephen Krashen is I'm a big proponent and advocate of his theories, and you know, immersion and again ACTFL, that 90% in the target language, those position statements are valuable, and I have to say that's really a model to follow.
I want to get to one or two more phone calls before we have to take a break. Katie is in New Haven. Hello, Katie.
Hi.
So I think that you're going to talk about something that is unfortunately to me near and dear to my heart. You studied Latin for years?
I did. My undergrad is in Latin.
Your undergrad? Okay. What now?
Yeah, I come from a large Catholic family. I was the only one to go to public school here in Connecticut, and my family really encouraged me to take Latin. I also took Spanish, and I really didn't learn Spanish until I, you know, backpacked in South America when I was 22. But my Latin, I found invaluable to the rest of my studies. I mean, I ended up getting into a PhD program in biostatistics at Yale, and I have to tell you, I really think that doing a language like Latin can be critical for someone who wants to expand their studies in mathematics. And I have a concern that in the United States we don't think about it the way they do in other countries, that, you know, you use English as sort of a way to get to where you want to go in your studies or in your life. And I don't know. I just wondered what everybody thought about that.
Well, and I will put that to our guest. I will just say to you, Katie, when I saw this pop up on the board here, I took Latin in college, and it is literally the only class in my entire life as a scholar that I ever failed. And I did it more than once. I retained no Latin skills whatsoever to this day. And I have a bit of PTSD around Latin, but I appreciate your phone call very much.
Thanks for taking it.
Yeah, thank you for raising that. Any quick thoughts, because we have to break, about Latin and the value, perhaps, Claire, of learning a language like Latin to help boost up some of your other language skills?
Well, I am also rather biased because my undergraduate degree was joint in classics and linguistics, so I did 4 years of Latin too. I would say that I think the value for offering a wide variety of languages in the curriculum is absolutely immense, as we've seen from Katie's comments here.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking a bit more about dual language learning. I want to thank Beth Lapman, who's president of the Connecticut Council of Language Teachers and director of World Languages at Hamden Public Schools, for spending some time with us today. Beth, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you want to join our conversation, 860-275-7266. We're talking about languages here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, we've talked a lot about the addictive qualities of opioids, but not as much about the deaths or severe symptoms of withdrawal in opioid users who never knew they were addicted until they stopped taking the drugs. Is it time to take a closer look at how we treat pain in America? Another look at opioids here on Where We Live, coming up on Monday's show. Hope you can join us. Today we're talking in the program about learning language, native English speakers learning foreign languages, and also those learning English as a second or third language. We're talking with Claire Bowern, who's Associate Professor of Linguistics at Yale University. She joins us from the Yale Studios in New Haven today. Joining us by phone now is Enrique Sepulveda, who is Professor and Chair of the Education Department at the University of St. Joseph. And Enrique, welcome to our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, John. Appreciate for being invited.
We've been talking a lot about different ways to acquire languages, including English as a second language programs, but you work in dual language programs. We've already talked a bit about how beneficial they can be. Can you explain how this is different than some of the traditional ways in which we teach people who come to the United States without English language skills, how this may be more beneficial to them?
Yes. The vast majority of students that are categorized as English language learners are in English-only, pretty much English-only settings. They could be push-in, ESL push-in or ESL pull-out models in English mainstream classes. Over the years, the past 30 years, in fact, we've had a number of different bilingual programs that emerge, and the most kind of exciting one has been a dual language immersion program. And one of the reasons that's exciting for a lot of people is that it brings English-only speaking students, five-year-olds in kindergarten, and another language group into the same classroom. So most dual language immersion programs are Spanish-English. So in a kindergarten class, kindergarten class, you will have 50% English-only speakers and 50% Spanish speakers or Chinese speakers. So that integrative quality is very exciting for a lot of people because it overcomes the segregation, cultural isolation issues that plague many of our schools.
So
that's one big issue.
Yeah, well, and from a very technical standpoint, how does it work? So you have a split or mixed classroom of people who have English skills and maybe not the other language, and then the other way around. So how does it work in the classroom?
Yeah, so one of the questions I ask my students, because we study the stuff in our programs here at University of St. Joseph, I said, why is it that an English-only student can be successful in a dual-language immersion program, bilingual immersion program, as a five-year-old and not see the same kinds of success for Spanish-only speaking students in an all-English classroom? Mm-hmm. And it has a lot to do with the number of factors. When a Spanish-speaking kid from Puerto Rico or Mexico or Peru comes to our schools, they come to an English-only setting primarily where the teacher hasn't been trained to work with that second language learner. The teacher hasn't been prepared to be able to tap into the cultural linguistic resources and insights of that student. That's not the case for the dual language immersion teacher. The dual language immersion teacher has been trained pedagogically in terms of curricular development and assessment to be able to tap into the insights and the richness and the abilities of kids who are learning the second language, whether it be Spanish for English speakers and dual language immersion, or Spanish speakers learning English. So it sounds like a trick question, but mm-hmm. but the whole program is set up for kids to negotiate that second language model
and essentially set up for these kids to succeed. One of the big worries about many students coming from other countries or without English language skills is that they are not only being taught primarily English by people who are trained to only teach in that language, but then they're being tested mostly in that language, which they have not yet acquired.
Exactly.
And that's one of the big problems, I think, Enrique, for our education system, is that we're essentially testing people as though they know
right.
the language already,
right.
and that
right.
sets many, many students and their schools back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the elements of major reforms in the education reforms in the country, Common Core, standardized testing, they're silent and were not made for English language learners. So the testing regimen that we have, they were not norm reference on English language learners from any country. So so that test is not a valid, reliable test to be able to ascertain their content knowledge or abilities in that language. So that's the first problem. The other issue is which I mentioned to one of your producers early in the week, is that when five-year-olds, English-speaking five-year-olds, come into school, they will have a whole range of experiences with the English language, from formal settings of doctor's offices, churches, ceremonies, to informal language settings such as neighborhood, playgrounds, and whatnot. And so then they come to, as 5-, 6-, 7-, 8-year-olds come to schools, beginning to then take a crack at formalized academic English, another kind of register, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Spanish-speaking kids, Chinese-speaking kids don't have that in the English language. So they're being exposed to a very highly technical, highly, very stylized linguistic register in the schools. And so a lot of that, and to top it off, a lot of that is very decontextualized from real meaning-making situations. So you see a lot of worksheets in the ESL programs. You see a lot of elimination of the native language. So what the kids know and what the kids come with is not built on. So there's a number of problems here for English language learners.
Well, and Claire, as you write, you said earlier, and as we're hearing from Enrique, programs like this work. And so what is the barrier, Claire, do you think, to more schools adopting programs like the ones that we're talking about?
I'd say there were three barriers. One is funding. As Beth mentioned earlier, there's a funding crisis for this sort of program in this country and also in this state. A second problem is the availability of teachers who have the requisite training. So there are just not as many teachers as there should be who have training in this area. And the third is the monolingual mindset that we've talked about several times already. If we have voters legislating against using particular pedagogical techniques in classrooms on the basis of opinion rather than evidence, then I think that's also a problem.
And Enrique, to get back to that point, one of our earlier callers who has taught said that he encountered this. It is something that we see as a mindset that indeed, in many parts of America, even amongst many Americans, there is a thought that if you come to live in this country, learning English is the most important thing, and there's just not a value placed on people who are able to learn 2 and 3 languages if English isn't the first one. And I assume of all the barriers that we have, that's probably still the biggest one.
Yeah, it's there are cultural and political, you know, elements in our society that prevents us from thinking, you know, and moving forward. When I was a kid growing up in California, English is my second language, and I entered school as a Spanish-speaking kid. And one of the things my teachers would say to me, and they were good-natured, warm, loving people, but they would say, "Now, Enrique, you have to learn English and become an American." Mind you, they never said stop speaking Spanish and stop being Mexican, but that was implied. And so there's this other layer of language learning that has to do with identity formation and cultural belonging. So as I learn English as a second language, the message was loud and clear: do not be Mexican, do not speak Spanish, and belong to this other group that I somehow could never belong until I got much older. But there's a cultural identity component to this that's much more complex than meets the eye.
It's complex, but so important, right? I mean, the idea that
totally
your language
important.
Is essentially being killed along with your culture is something that I must cut deeply at a young student.
Yeah, culture is dynamic. Culture changes all the time, so we know that. But when a 5-, 6-, 7-, 8-year-old kid comes and is being told, given these messages in an explicit or implicit manner, There's a loss, a psychological, emotional cost to this process that affects the cognitive, the optimal learning environment. One of the things that you hear, and this is always amazed me, when I was growing up in California, educators were straight up, this is America, learn English.
Yeah.
Now you hear an interesting kind of take. They say, well, Enrique, we have so many languages now. We have 100 languages in the state of Connecticut, let's just say.
Yeah.
you know, we can't teach all of them. So they use the diversity argument to not address the diverse needs of kids, which is kind of like the ultimate irony.
It's such an interesting topic, and one that I wish we had more time for. Enrique Sepulveda is professor and chair of the Education Department at the University of St. Joseph. Thank you for joining us. Also, thanks to Claire Bowern, the professor of linguistics at Yale University. Thanks to Nicole Wetzman, who produced our program today. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.